Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the Megedi Investments. Investments Trust is one of the most unique portfolios of any investment trust listed in London. We're going to be delving down into the underlying holdings. We're also going to be looking at where the managers see value in the year ahead. And kindly today, we have two guests with us. First of all, we have Dan Higgins, who is the founder and CEO of Marylebone Partners, who is the manager of the Megedi Investments Investment Trust. And we also have James Bloomer, who is a senior analyst at Marylebone Partners. Dan, James, very much welcome you to the podcast today.
Thank you. Good morning, Jonathan.
So before we get into it, this is going to be a really comprehensive conversation today. Very much looking forward to it. Please, could we have an introduction to both of you, Dan and James, please? And then afterwards, Dan, if you could give us an introduction to Megedi Investments and your investment strategy, please.
Yes, so I'm Dan Higgins. I'm, as you said, I'm the founder and chief executive of Marylebone Partners. We invest money for primarily families, charitable endowments and individuals, and we also are the manager of Megedi, a listed investment trust. We became the manager of Megedi in early 2023, and since we last spoke, our firm has become part of Brown Advisory, which itself is an independent investment business, which we believe will bring us lots of resources and access to new ideas, but nothing will change in terms of autonomy, decision making, or the mandate that we have for Megedi.
Hi, Jonathan. I'm a senior analyst at Marylebone. I've been working with Dan for 9 years, and I spend most of my time on the external manager side of things alongside our co-investment program.
Thank you. And I believe we're going to be discussing Asia and China in some detail later on in the podcast, James, and that's something you're going to be getting stuck into for listeners. So very much looking forward to that. So let's start from the top, if we may, and ask the role that Megedi plays for shareholders. Of course, at this point in time, a lot of investment trusts have deep discounts. In some cases, they're widening. But looking at Megedi, we're actually seeing a real narrowing there, which is particularly interesting. It would be really good if we could start off with what you're doing for investors, what your strategy is, and what you feel that you're doing differently at this point in time.
So we have bucked the trend somewhat. And Marylebone Partners was announced as the new manager of Megedi in October 2022. Quick glance at my screen reminds me that the NAV at that time was 227p a share. The share price was 160p a share. So trading at a pretty sizable discount. And as of today, the NAV has grown to 310p and the share price is 270, something like that. So the discount has narrowed as well as the NAV having gone up. And when I look back on what's occurred since we became the new manager, but also when I think about everything that's gone on within the sector over that period, it feels to me that there are probably three or four things that are making the difference between trusts that have managed to hold or even narrow their discounts and those that have seen them widen. So first of all, I think it's absolutely critical that an investment trust like ours tries to find a way or is capable of delivering positive absolute returns, inflation beating absolute returns in a world that has changed. It's quite apparent to us that interest rates are structurally higher than they were before. There's going to be more dispersion within markets, and a lot of the things that worked in a previous low interest rate regime are not going to work going forward. So number one is to have any right to exist and to attract shareholders, you have to convince them that you can deliver good absolute returns that will beat inflation. Second criterion, in my opinion, is that there needs to be true alignment between manager and shareholders. So for example, a manager should be paid on the share price, the market cap, not on NAV. The manager should be invested in the trust alongside their clients. We're meaningful investors in Megedi ourselves. The third criterion is that you have to be giving investors something that they can't get elsewhere, and certainly they can't get elsewhere for less. So in the case of Megedi, we have barely any exposure to, example, to Magnificent Seven stocks. And as far as I'm aware, there is no other way investors can access the sorts of things that feature in Magedi's portfolio. So it's got to be truly differentiated. And then the final criterion is that what you do or what you own can't be deeply illiquid or for there to be real ambiguity around pricing. So although we take advantage of the investment trust structure and look at things that you couldn't do within a UCITS fund, let's say, everything we invest in is priced independently on a regular basis. So there's no existential question about whether the net asset value really is the net asset value. So in my opinion, what Magedi is trying to deliver and what I hope it can bring to its shareholders is to deliver really good, high quality and differentiated absolute returns that should be run ahead of inflation, and we're doing it in a different way. That means there's scarcity value. It's something that you couldn't get elsewhere.
Thank you, Dan. And I don't think you can understate the differentiated approach of Magedi. We have the privilege of speaking to many investment trust managers, and I don't think that there is another investment trust out there which can match Magedi in terms of the diversity and access, as you mentioned, Dan, to investments that you just can't get elsewhere. And I believe there's a slightly contrarian approach to the portfolio, which we'll probably get onto a little bit later on in the podcast. But how important is that to the strategy? Is it something that you've set out to do in terms of being contrarian, or is it something that's happened as a byproduct of investing in investments that you really see value in, but they just happen to be going against the major trends at that point in time?
That is a good question. I would say that it is by design that we invest in non-consensual investments, but it's not our specific intention to do so. So what I mean by that is we want to deliver the best absolute returns per unit of accompanying risk. And we have found consistently that the greatest margin of safety, the greatest opportunity to make people money without taking visible or invisible risks, is to look for those ideas in less obvious areas, in areas where the probability of future outcomes is not discounted in today's prices. So we know we can't predict the future. We make no attempt to time markets. We don't think like other people in terms of making asset class return projections, but we do look for our ideas and our opportunities off the beaten track. So one of the reasons we're quite excited about the opportunity set today is so much capital has been channeled into such a narrow part of the market. It leaves lots and lots of opportunity to find those things in more esoteric areas. The areas that we think have the best prospect of making good returns are in many cases less risky, and that's just because valuations are lower. And so I think that we're having this conversation at what could turn out to be a really pivotal moment in financial markets, because for much of the last 10 or 15 years, there's been no tension between trying to beat an index and trying to deliver good absolute returns. If you've beaten the index, you have delivered good absolute returns. And the extraordinary thing about the composition of markets today means that if your primary objective is to beat an index, you have to take on a lot of risks that I just don't think are necessary. So that's a long-winded way of saying we're not specifically trying to go out there and find contrarian investments, as you put it, but because we always look in areas where the margin of safety is greater, we're just naturally led towards differentiated ideas that tend not to feature elsewhere. So the secondary benefit is many of our shareholders can own Magedi alongside other more conventional assets, and they're getting diversification as well as hopefully return potential.
So the last time we spoke, Dan, last year, we spoke about your deliberate avoidance of the Mag 7 stocks, and as you've just alluded to there, and you obviously see that as a risk. How do you see that risk developing, and how has that developed over the last year? Because they still, to some extent, are dominant, maybe less dominant, but how do you see that playing out this year?
First thing is to say is I don't believe there's a bubble in Mag 7 stocks. I've been doing this long enough. I remember the dot-com bubble, and whilst there are pockets of the markets today that are just highly speculative, and there are companies that not only don't have any earnings, but they don't have any revenues on crazy multiples. That is not the case with Mag 7 stocks. They're, by and large, they're fantastic companies, and it's really important to recognize their outperformance is largely, but not entirely, attributable to superior earnings growth. So the reason it's not where we have chosen to allocate a meaningful portion of the portfolio is that we feel expectations in those stocks are now very high, and the range of future outcomes is very wide. Nobody knows whether specifically the hyperscalers, so that's kind of four or five of the seven, nobody knows whether they will or will not sufficient return on the $1 trillion or so they're going to spend on AI over the next 3 or 4 years. They might, but nobody knows. And so again, on a margin of safety basis, we just feel there are other areas that have much higher visibility of earnings and cash flows and where valuations are more reasonable or expectations are lower. And that's where we prefer to focus. So on the Mag 7, I don't know. I feel much higher conviction about the things that feature in our portfolio that they will deliver the sort of absolute return that we're looking for, which is typically between, I don't know, 10 to 15% return potential per annum.
And we're going to bring James in a little bit later on in the podcast to discuss some of those investments, particularly in Asia and China. But I would like to just stick with the US for a moment, Dan, and look beyond the Mag 7 and the equity markets, because of course, the US has been a driving force for the global economy and is likely to continue to be, as well as their equity markets driving the global equity market. But there are cracks appearing, you know, especially what we've been seeing in the last couple of weeks or so. From where you're sitting down, what tells you that this US exceptionalism may not continue as long as people may think or like to think?
So part of me subscribes to the Warren Buffett view that you should never bet against America, that it is the most entrepreneurial, innovative, creative culture in the world. There will almost certainly be more great companies and innovation to come out of America than any other single country over the next 10 to 20 years, with the possible exception of China, I suppose. And I think it would be arrogant to bet against America, notwithstanding a lot of the troubling things we all see on a societal and political level going on there. But to answer your question, in terms of investment opportunity, we just see a lot more opportunity in other parts of the world. Now, within the US, we do have exposure to the US, of course, in our portfolio for Megedi. So US equities comprise around 2/3 of global market capitalization, and they're about 1/3 of our equity-centric component of our portfolio. So the two areas where we have most exposure are themselves quite contrarian areas. So we have exposure to mid-cap biotech, which I think we talked about last time you and I spoke, and so very selectively to software, which is an area that the market believes is a massive AI loser. And we think it's a bit more nuanced than that. So there's selectively some opportunity there. But we're just finding proportionally many more of the ideas in other parts of the world. So US, as I said, US share of market cap is 60% plus, its highest level in 20 years. US is 26% of global GDP. So there is a bit of a disconnect there. And if you'll allow me just for a couple of minutes, I'll just highlight why we think this could be, a pivotal moment, and we intend to take advantage of it. So one of the metrics that we're looking at very closely is what's called the net international investment position. So put simply, this is a number that tells you what is the value of US assets owned by foreigners less the foreign holdings of US allocators. And in 2009, at the bottom of markets after the financial crisis, that number, the net international investment position, was minus $2.6 trillion. In other words, foreigners owned $2.6 trillion more of US assets than Americans owned of theirs. As of today, that number is nearly $28 trillion. So since the global financial crisis, 20-something trillion dollars of US assets have been bought by foreigners. And that may be US treasuries, it may be US equities, it could be real estate, it could be absolutely anything. But that is a seismic shift. And it explains, in part, why US equities have outperformed everything else. And it explains why the US dollar has outperformed all other currencies. And for a number of reasons, we question whether that is going to continue. And you don't need to see that $23, $24 trillion go back the other way in order for it to have a pretty profound impact on certain asset classes. You don't even need it to turn negative. You just need some of the incremental buying, the incremental pound or yen or euro to go somewhere other than the US for it to have a big impact on prices in other parts of the world. And so forgive me for being a bit kind of big picture on this stuff, but it just explains to me why the next 5 to 10 years could look very different to the last 5 to 10 years. And it explains why we're looking for most of our opportunities elsewhere. And then in terms of the two major implications, and this might then be a good segue into talking about Asia and what we're doing there, I think there are two major implications for Megedi's portfolio that may have broader read across. So the first one's currency. A lot of sterling investors have benefited from multi-year tailwinds for the US dollar, which may not persist for the reasons I mentioned. And Megedi is unequivocally should be thought of as a sterling asset. So with the exception of one sleeve of our portfolio, the what we call special investments, which we tend to leave in their base currency, our default is to mitigate non-US currency risk using currency forwards. So moves in sterling versus the dollar should not have a meaningful impact on the net asset value per share of Megedi in sterling. And just to illustrate why that's important, I gave a presentation to some Megedi investors maybe 12, 18 months ago, and it was entitled, "It Ain't Necessarily So," that certain things that a generation of allocators have assumed will be the case may not be the case. And one of them is currency. So if you had bought if a sterling investor had bought the US equity market at the absolute bottom after the dot-com bubble burst, I believe it was the spring of 2002, when almost to the day when US invaded Afghanistan, nearly two thirds of your subsequent gains between the bottom of the S&P 500 and the top just before the global financial crisis, they would have been wiped out by the dollar being weak against the pound. So the dollar went from 140 to 210 over that same period. And again, I'm not predicting that that's going to happen again, but I think the balance of risks has shifted, which is why we don't want to take a huge implicit view that the dollar is going to outperform all other currencies over the years ahead. And the second implication is for where we want to be placing our equity investments. As I said, two thirds of our equity investments are outside the US. And whilst that includes Europe and the UK, that's where a lot of our direct investments are, despite the not brilliant economy here, a large chunk of that, kind of 40, 50% of it is in Asia and emerging markets. And there haven't been two consecutive years of outperformance for emerging markets since 2010. Relative to the US, and we think there's a good chance that changes.
Thank you very much, Dan. You've done a fantastic job there of explaining why investors should look beyond conventional thinking. I'd like to bring James in now to actually discuss some of those opportunities that Megedi are offering investors. And I just want to pull out a quite an interesting stat that Dan mentioned there. And it was the US equity market accounting for about 60% of the total global equity market, whereas GDP is only around 20% of the overall globe. And I remember sitting in a presentation not too long ago, and I think the speaker at that point in time was highlighting China or emerging markets and the percentage of GDP that those markets had compared to the size of their equity markets, compared to the total equity markets. And it's the opposite situation there, where the total equity markets is a lot less than the actual GDP. So that's something that really highlights the opportunity in emerging markets. So James, why do you think that opportunity exists? What's been the driver of underperformance? And why do you think now is a point that this could change?
I think for China specifically, if you place yourself back 3 years ago, you would see headlines on a nearly daily basis talking about China being uninvestable. And there were very good reasons people were quite bearish about China at the time. There were all sorts of macro risks stemming from, I think, originally the property crackdown, and, you know, you could also point to policy-induced uncertainty at the time. And I think one of the ways that we think about it, and, you know, I've been very influenced by Dan Wong over time on this, it's kind of, we think about kind of the tension within China between ideology and pragmatism. In the kind of earlier COVID days, you know, of 2020, 2021, China really swung towards the ideological side of things with the property crackdown. And sort of after that, you know, you saw real cracks in the economy. And you know, alongside that, declining equity markets and all the other things that we all look at. That for us was very much the time to take a proper look at considering our overall exposure to China and whether that was the time to look.
It's interesting there. You mentioned the ideology side of things. Do you think that's one of the key perceived risks, that we have that discount in China and other emerging markets at the moment?
I think you have to be aware of ideology in China. You know, ultimately, kind of, it's the government plays a major role within the economy. There's no doubt about it, as governments do. You know, in the US, of course, they do as well. But when it comes down to it, we just look at things from a bottom-up point of view, and we're looking at whether there's an opportunity within a country. So in China, you know, we saw the real pain that was triggered by the property bubble bursting with the large knock-on effects. But at the same time, we had, you know, I went out several times over the last several few years, and we saw a recognition of those issues and a willingness and ability to do something about it. And that was, for us, that was triggered by the weakness in the economy. There's going to be a swing between the ideological and the pragmatic in the country. And they clearly saw that there needed to be a shift towards pragmatism. So you're now seeing Beijing much more willing to use supply-side discipline and targeted monetary tools alongside measures to stabilize the equity markets. I think anyone who tells you, you know, the government doesn't care about the equity markets, it's very clear they see it as a policy mechanism that they can use to sort of stabilize the economy in its way.
Indeed. I mean, China intervene in their equity markets in a way that no other major economy does. So you, of course, see value there, James. It'd be really interesting to hear and get a little bit more detail on how you're gaining exposure to that for investors in Magedi.
Absolutely. We see China as very much a specialists market, kind of adult swim only. And, you know, as much work as we do on the economy and on the politics and the companies in China, we very much see it as an area where we want to send that exposure to one of our specialists. So we're invested with a fund called the Perseverance DXF Value Fund. This is one of the eminent investment managers in China. They have a team on the ground in China of over 20 sector and subsector analysts. They're very much a value fund, and they have a fantastic ability to understand policy and politics alongside being incredibly bottom-up stock-picking investors. That's our main exposure to China today. But I should say, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about anti-involution and the idea there. We do have one of our special investments in a sector that could be a direct beneficiary of this anti-involution campaign.
I just want to go back to the fund that you mentioned there, James, and you may not be able to mention individual names, but I'd like to give listeners a flavour for the differentiation that you have exposure to, you know, as opposed to them going out and buying a China-focused fund or an emerging markets fund. You're obviously on the ground there. You're meeting people that have extensive teams there. As you mentioned, they're looking at the small cap markets. What type of things are they investing in, and how different are they to some of the other funds that investors may be able to get exposure to from a direct investment into a China-focused fund, for example?
You know, when I first met them years and years ago at this point, I think one of the things that really struck me about this fund and this portfolio manager was their ability to make money in sectors outside the obvious. Now, the obvious at the time were the, you know, the bellwether technology companies that had driven the markets up. And don't get me wrong, they participated nicely there, but they'd also been able to generate returns from utilities and the mining sector within China, really kind of off the beaten track ideas and the non-consensual areas in the market. So when you saw in 2021 the kind of the tide coming out, I think a lot of investors were caught offside there, especially in the kind of, if you remember the education companies at the time. Perseverance absolutely weren't. They participated in the few names that did well during that time and protected on the downside. So I think very highly of them, especially in terms of their sort of downside protection, but they managed to capture the upside through these kind of non-consensual, non-obvious ideas. I can't go into too many details on their actual names in the portfolio, I'm afraid.
Final question here on China. Of course, this is something that's been rumbling on now for some time, but it's their approach to Taiwan. How much of a concern is that for you as an investor in China? And how does that play into your investment strategy and your investment approach when you're looking at China?
It's an area we've, of course, spent a good amount of time on. I mean, for us, there's little doubt that the Chinese leadership and, very importantly, the vast majority of the Chinese population do see Taiwan as an essential part of China. Over the very long term, I do think they won't be dissuaded of that. I think one has to be aware of that. But in the meantime, there are a couple of things to think about. But in the near to medium term, we do think the risk is very low. First of all, you know, an actual invasion, it's not what they want to do. It's incredibly difficult to do an amphibious invasion of an island. The leadership, I think we've all seen the headlines, the leadership of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, has been frankly, decimated by the anti-corruption campaign, including generals that Xi himself appointed. So Zhang Yuxia and Liu Zhenli are under investigation for serious discipline violations. And we don't need to go into the weeds, but these are generals close to Xi. I think you don't launch a war when you've just replaced most of your generals. And you can see that the Chinese Communist Party embedding themselves within the politics of Taiwan in an effort to undermine the supporters of independence. You know, if you were to see a big shift from the US towards recognition of Taiwan, I think, okay, that could be something that would change our mind about this. I don't think that the Chinese would stand for that. But at the same time, we think it's a risk that's appropriately handicapped for us.
Thank you very much, James. I'd like to bring Dan back in now and look at a broad overview of Magellan, because we spoke in detail there about China. Thank you very much, James. But I just want to put that into context of the overall portfolio, how that fits into the big weightings that you have within the portfolio. And really, Dan, if you could give us a flavour, of course, bringing it back to China and your external managers there, but then how the fund is constructed in terms of weighting to external managers, the different buckets and strategies that you have within the portfolio, as well as a little bit on the geographical breakdown, if you may.
Yeah, so I'll do it fairly high level, Jonathan, and then for detail, I'd just refer any listeners to the website, which gives this a lot more granularity. So by way of quick reminder, we have three component strategies. So the largest of those, about 60% of the total, we call external managers. And here we've identified a relatively small number of what we believe to be world-class fundamental investors operating in structurally inefficient areas. And as I said, top of the podcast, our entry point is very often when there is a dislocation or other allocators have dismissed or jettisoned a certain area as uninvestable, and we think that that's not the case. So this is where the Perseverance Fund that James was just talking about sits within this category, but we also have a mid-cap biotech specialist and a Japan small-cap activist and a European deep value manager and a handful of distressed debt specialists. So each of them very, very different, and each of them is a true expert in a structurally inefficient area. And as you heard also a while ago, the bias there is very much towards, it's equity-centric, and it is biased towards international opportunities rather than US opportunities. The second part of the portfolio we call direct investments. So these are stocks selected by our in-house team, which has just expanded meaningfully as a consequence of the tie-up with Brown Advisory. And here we own a focused selection of individual equities, each of which we think is misunderstood, unappreciated, or where the quality of the business has yet to be reflected in prices. So as of today, we own about 10 stocks directly, and they tend to be mid-cap names with a strong bias towards the UK and Europe. So we own some UK stocks like Computer Centre or Weir Group, IMI PLC, some European names. We recently established a position in a company called All Funds. And then I think we only own one US stock directly today, which is SS&C, a software company. So that the direct investments is kind of 15 to 20% of the portfolio. And then the third bit, I hope my numbers add up to 100-ish, another 15 to 20% is in what we call special investments. And these are opportunities brought to us through an ideas network that we've built up over 25 years or so in the business. These are opportunities to invest alongside some of the world's best investors in their highest conviction ideas. So since 2017, we have been invested in the listed uranium space through a chap called Mike Alkin, who's based in the States, who has become something of a leader in that rather esoteric sector. We have made some co-investments in public equities in Brazil with a group called Hicks Capital, or in a US healthcare company, CVS, with a group called Glenview in the States. We've done some litigation finance in Spain. And as James mentioned, one Chinese idea brought to us by a group called JB Investments, who we've known for over a decade. So this stuff is high return potential, definitely a wider range of outcomes. So we are looking for 20% plus IRRs from this area, but it must come from a trusted source and we must feel we can monetize it within 3 years. So again, it's not private equity, it's not venture capital, it's somewhat liquid underlying. So you put all those three things together and we think you get a really eclectic mix of investments that could not be more different to one another. So there's a real portfolio benefit because each investment has a different source of return. You do get a degree of diversification, but you're not diluting your return potential. And yeah, I would say we're turning down a lot of stuff that looks interesting at first glance because it doesn't meet our return requirements or the risk is unacceptable. And that becomes so much easier to do because there's a lot of other things we already own and are looking at that we feel very strongly about. So yeah, markets, especially in the States, may be at close to all-time highs, but the stuff we own in many cases has been overlooked or forgotten.
Thank you. And as Dan mentioned, for any listeners that would like to get some further information and really drill down into the Majedi Investments Investment Trust, do check out the notes to this podcast because there'll be a link through to their fact sheets where you'll be able to really get a flavour for the diversification that Dan has outlined there. So to finish off, we always like to ask our guests on the podcast what's exciting them the most about the year ahead. And because we have the privilege of having both of you today, I'll direct my first question at James and focusing on China. James, as an investor in China, what excites you the most about 2026?
I think one of the things we're beginning to see, and we've been watching it for a while, and it's been a thesis up till now, but I think we're beginning to see it, is the massive excess savings that were built up over COVID within the population. Those are now being directed into sort of various kind of bond-like financial instruments and gold. We're now beginning to see that flow into the equity market. And I think kind of those sort of levels of flows, domestic flows not reliant on foreign inbound allocations, I think that could be a real driver of the equity market over the year ahead. I think it's, yeah, really, really worth watching that.
Thank you very much. And Dan, I'm going to ask you not about any individual investment, but more about the overall strategy and your approach to seeking out investments that are somewhat under the radar. From the strategy that you've put in place and the portfolio you have at the moment, from a very top level, what makes you optimistic about the year ahead?
As you would expect, there are specific areas that we're excited about, and at the risk of appearing too promotional, I think a lot of the special investments, that there's been quite long gestation period and we feel that there are events ahead that could lead them to spring to life quite quickly. James, who's probably the best travelled member of our team, has not only been to China in the last year, but recently came back from Korea. We're also doing a lot of work. And although that market went up a lot last year, most stocks within the market didn't. So that's one to watch. I would say what really makes me optimistic about Majedi is that I believe the tectonic plates are just shifting in markets. And we had a little dress rehearsal of this in April of last year when the whole tariff fiasco played out. It will not take much to trigger meaningful reallocation of capital leaving the US and going into other areas. And we own a lot of fundamentally attractive, undervalued stuff that's in the other areas. So if I'm wrong and we find ourselves in 3 years' time still saying that markets went back to the playbook that had worked very well over the past 10 or 15 years, then I think we'll do just fine in absolute terms. But if I'm right and people start to pay attention to specific opportunities in Europe, even in the UK, in Asia, I think we'll do extremely well for Majedi's shareholders at a time when other things might not be doing so well. And so for me, 2026 could be the year in which absolute return investors, the advantage that we have over relative return investors who are obliged to compete against a benchmark that increasingly bears no resemblance to their actual objectives, I think we're at a huge advantage, and that 2026 and beyond is going to be the time when that starts to really, really pay off.
Thank you very much. One thing we haven't touched on, just like to wrap up with here, is returns to shareholders and dividends and such. Like, if you could just touch on those and what your strategy is there, that would be fantastic, please.
Yes. So Majedi pays a nice dividend to shareholders of around 3% on an annual basis. We also, it's worth mentioning, in the past year, we also paid off a long-standing debenture. So that's a saving to Majedi's shareholders of 0.5% or more a year in interest that we're no longer paying. We do have a facility in place so we can take advantage of dislocations. So it should be thought of in a total return basis as an investment, Majedi. In terms of capital allocation, the board will always do what it believes is in the best interest of shareholders. And at this moment in time, we're sufficiently full of good ideas and think we can earn a really nice return by deploying cash in our investments, we think that's by far the best use of shareholders' capital. We are ambitious for Majedi and we want to grow it over time. And that's why we care not just about the NAV, but about the share price. You know, critical to our ambitions and desire to grow Majedi is that we perform well and that is reflected in the share price, not just the NAV. So we're shareholders along with your other listeners, and that's what we're focused on.
That's really encouraging to hear, Dan, that you have the conviction in your ideas to opt for deploying that cash in investments as opposed to opting for share buybacks. Nothing wrong with share buybacks. They do help manage the NAV, but really refreshing to hear that you are actually sticking to your gun, sticking to your ideas and opting to deploy that cash and build that longer term value than actually looking at shareholder returns through share buybacks. So thank you very much for outlining that. And just as a final note to listeners, if you do want to find out more about Majedi Investments, do look at the notes to this podcast. There'll be a link through to their website. We'll be able to download further information. So Dan and James, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.